supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I began my career in the 70s, and I was specializing in substance abuse for a little more than a decade. Well, among many things I learned during that decade, I learned how difficult it was for substance abusers to get treatment and find jobs and create a social support network that would help them find some quality in their lives. Well, in those 40 years, we've learned a great deal about the physiology and psychology of substance abuse. We've developed new treatments and new ways of understanding the illness, but 40 years later, it's still difficult to get quality treatment, find jobs, and create a support system. And why? For my money? Stigma. On today's guest, we'll talk about drug and alcohol addiction and stigma. My guests are Beth Grant, Dennis Franklin, and Dr. David Rosenblum. Beth joins us here in the studio. She's the mother of a son who has battled heroin addiction, I guess technically still is. Dennis Franklin manages outpatient care at Livingren Hospital, I guess hospital technically. That's a treatment center in Fort Washington. I want to welcome you both to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In a little while, we'll hear from David Rosenblum. He's a professor of public health at Boston University. He directs a program called Join Together. It helps communities prevent and reduce alcohol and drug programs. Later on, we're going to talk with WHYY's behavioral health reporter, Mike and Scott, about a mural arts project that addresses addiction and has communities talking about it. But first, let's start chatting with... First, I want to give the numbers. Sorry. 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We're talking about substance abuse, but mostly we want to focus on stigma, what we can do about it, and what its implications are. So, Beth, you have dealt with your son's addiction for the better part of a decade. Tell us why you're talking about it publicly.
Well, most of the time when you hear people talking about addiction in a child, they come to it after the loss of a child. And I want people to know that there can be wonderful outcomes and that there are so many people who live among us who are recovered addicts and who are pillars of their communities, who are wonderful people. They're your friends. And we shouldn't be ashamed or embarrassed about seeking help when we need it. That if I think some of the stigma is self-imposed.
How so?
We're embarrassed. You know, your natural tendency is, initially when you find out your child is a drug addict, is just abject horror. What did I do wrong? How did this happen to me? And you need to separate yourself from that. In the case of...
That's easy to say.
Actually, as you go deeper and deeper into working with your loved one, it becomes easier and easier. Because pride, I think that pride and shame are the opposite sides of the same coin. And if you are someone who's proud and who says, this doesn't happen in our family, you're struck much more by shame. And fortunately, we had no pride. So it was easy for us to feel no shame. We weren't constrained by what will people think, because we were well established in our community. Neither my husband nor I were drinkers or had any substance abuse issues. And quite frankly, when it happened to us, people were shocked. And it was a good opportunity to say, you know what? If it can happen to us, it can happen to anyone. And so, oh, go ahead.
You see this look on my face?
Yes.
It's kind of a quizzical look.
Yes.
Well, here's why. You said we're well established in the community. And 99 out of 100 who are well established in the community would feel more social anxiety about it than less, more shame or pride or whatever label mm-hmm. we're using. So you're telling us something about you and your husband. It's kind of surprising that you didn't.
Our primary concern was finding support for our son. And the best way we felt to approach that was to find support within our community, use the resources within our community, and say, this has happened to us. What do you know about this world? We know nothing about this. So we talked to everyone about it.
I know you don't want this discussion to be just about your family, and neither do I, but I do want to kind of use that to mm-hmm. help understand. Your son began using drugs when he was 14.
Yes.
So what happened right at the beginning when all this started? What was happening with him, and what impact did it have on you?
Well, when we first caught him, the first time I caught him smoking pot in our home with another friend, I immediately called the other parents. Not as a punitive thing, but as a, let's brainstorm. You know, let's work together and see how we can deal with this. And their reaction was, well, we'll not have our son at your house again. And I said, that's not the point. The point is, this is something that's emerging, and we need to work on it together. And I did find, many parents weren't willing to have this conversation with me. But fortunately, it didn't bother me. I mean, I wasn't hurt by it or insulted by it.
So I am watching you, Dennis, giving us this knowing look, like, been there, done that.
Yeah, and I'm very impressed that you took the steps that you did in order to facilitate your son's recovery process. But that's really not usually the norm. Right. It really is quite the opposite, so I really commend you for doing that.
Oh, thank you.
That's why I was looking at her, like she had three heads.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, why we've had a successful outcome, because we always mm-hmm. looked at it head on. Mm-hmm. We were very, very direct with him, mm-hmm. with his peer group, with other parents, mm-hmm. and with people in the community. Now, I worked closely with his DARE officer, even though he had graduated from fifth grade 5 years earlier. Yeah. That was my first phone call, was to say, you know, help me.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for me?
Yeah, it's interesting. You intuitively knew what to do, and some of the things you're talking about are the things that we ask people to do. But the denial of the other family members was obvious to me. They weren't going to send their kids to your home anymore.
I know, which was so funny.
When we spoke to you earlier, Beth, you said there was a great deal of substance abuse in your community.
Yes.
And we're talking about hard drugs. You were living in a middle-upper middle-class community.
Yes. Yes.
At the time. And so what happened when you tried to reach out? You tried to mobilize the community to deal with this. The school, too, yes?
I did.
And?
There were various reactions. The school said, we don't have a drug problem. You're mistaken.
When was this?
Yeah, but this is years ago, and things have changed. Our son will be, is almost 25. So 10 years ago, everything's changed, I think. He's been sober for over 4 years.
Your son went from marijuana to heroin.
Yes. Actually, from marijuana to OxyContin to heroin.
When did you discover he was using heroin?
I think when he was 19.
What impact did this have on you?
Oh, it was devastating. It's funny, we knew that he was using OxyContin, and that was bad enough. We had kicked him out of the house, and we always offered him rehab or living on his own. You know, we said, we will do whatever it takes to help you get through rehab, or you can't live with us. And it's funny because OxyContin addiction and heroin addiction are really the same thing, but everyone thinks, oh, they're not, but they really are in fact the same type of addiction. And it was devastating because the word heroin is so, like, dirty.
It's a dirty word.
It's a dirty word. And when I spoke to friends about it and I would say, my son's a heroin addict, they would recoil and say, how can you say that about him? I'd say, it's true. They'd say, it can't be true. And after I said the word about 100 times, it became very easy to say the word.
How did your friends and community react to you?
To me personally?
Did you get support from your community?
In any community, there are going to be people who will support you, your true friends. There will be people who delight in your misery. And then there are people who are completely confused about how to react to you. So they relied on me for guidance about how I wanted to be treated.
You experienced a good deal of stigma. You tell a story about a casserole.
Someone in my neighborhood unfortunately developed breast cancer, and one of my neighbors asked me if I would get on the meal list to make a meal a week for this family. And this is at a time when we were in full involvement with our son's heroin addiction, and we were just drained. And I said to her, I can't imagine signing up for a casserole a week with what we're going through in our own house. And she said, oh, well, I was thinking this might take your mind off of your own problems. And I thought, you know what? We have a terminally ill child. Why aren't you making me a casserole?
Nobody would have ever thought that.
No.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Glenn on the line, apropos of community support. Glenn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's hard to hear you.
Can you hear me now?
A little bit better.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I called in because we lost our son on the 9th of September to heroin.
Oh.
And it's still quite raw, but we want to help other people. Even at the memorial, my wife read something to our son's friends just so that they don't think that this is an excuse to continue to use, but to, you know, get help, feel your pain as everybody feels pain, and to move on with life.
How did your son live and die, Glenn?
Well, he lived an exciting life, and he was very vibrant, and he struggled with the addiction for probably only a year and a half. But he felt very stigmatized by it. He didn't want people to know that he was an addict. He did work with NA and AA groups, and they supported him. He used the night before and actually went to a favorite spot in the park, and we believe just fell asleep. We haven't received all the reports, but it was due to his heroin use.
I'm so sorry about your loss. Glenn, tell us the message you want to teach others.
We want kids and parents to know that it shouldn't be a stigma and it shouldn't be put under the carpet. We even mentioned at the memorial that we're going to have armbands made that are the same color as the heroin bags, put his name on it so that it's in your face, they know it's real, and it'll go towards prevention education.
Dennis, you wanted to...
Well, I just wanted to say one of the things that keeps coming into my mind as we're speaking here is the stigma grows with the terminology that we use. And I think sometimes we have to think about, if you say the word addict, you know, it brings up a whole bunch of thoughts to your mind. If you say the word substance use disorder, then it puts a different kind of connotation on it, so that we start to look at it as the disease that it is. And I think that sometimes we need to take a look at those kinds of things.
Yeah, and how they're used.
And how they're used, right.
Glenn, tell us how you are. Are you there, Glenn?
Yeah. We're still quite upset, and we're reliving different parts of the moments. But we also know that our son was very positive, and he would stay on the phone all night with friends who were battling things, and he helped everyone. So we are channeling all the positive energy and the things that we learned from him to see if we can help other people. So we have moments in the morning and the evening that are rough, but just trying to channel it in the right way.
Well, Glenn, I am so very grateful for you that you called the show and you shared your story with us. And I do wish the best for you. And I do hope that you and your family are so very successful, like I wish that for the rest of us, about getting the message out and putting a human face on this situation.
Yeah, thank you, Dan.
Please take care, Glenn. We are going to take a short break now. We're talking about addiction and stigma and the terrible price that comes with stigma. There's research I read earlier that only 10% of people who are substance abusers get the treatment they need, and a lot of that is just because of the stigma. We've been talking with Beth Grant, who's the mother of a son who's battled heroin addiction, and Dennis Franklin, who manages outpatient care at the Livingren Foundation, a treatment center here in Fort Washington. When we come back, we'll hear from them in our third segment, but when we come back, we're going to hear from Dr. David Rosenblum. He's a professor of public health at Boston University and directs Join Together, a program that helps communities prevent and even reduce alcohol and drug problems. Our number here is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, managing severe orthopedic injury and disease. Their joint replacement program has received the Blue Distinction Award for excellence and quality care. Whether due to arthritis or a severe injury, Cooper physicians precisely align your hip, knee, or shoulder replacement. Tough injuries, skilled physicians. Cooper Bone and Joint Institute. Locations in South Jersey and Newtown Square. CooperHealth.org/numbers or 800-8-COOPER.
On the next Fresh Air, talking people out of truly desperate situations. Gary Nessner spent 30 years as a hostage negotiator. He tells us that diffusing a crisis starts with establishing trust, projecting sincerity, and on rare occasions, you have to lie. Nessner's new book is called Stalling for Time. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about addiction and stigma, what it means, why it exists in the face of all we're learning about addiction, and hopefully what we can do about it. So we're going to be talking now with David Rosenblum. He's a professor of public health at BU, and he directs a program called Join Together. David Rosenblum, welcome to the show.
Thank you for doing this show.
There's an article just released by the American Journal of Psychiatry that showed that although more people understand that addiction is a disease, stigma has been untouched. Now, that certainly hasn't been the case with cancer or even other mental illnesses. The stigma around depression and bipolar disorder have been somewhat diminished. Why not substance abuse?
The fundamental thing we need to understand about this disease, and it is a disease of the brain and behavior, is that addiction affects the brain in a way that causes you to continue to use the drug or the alcohol even in the face of negative consequences, even knowing there are going to be negative consequences. So the definition of addiction is essentially uncontrollable use. So while people generally recognize that this is a disease more frequently than they did in the past, they still have this reaction, well, why don't they just stop? And so they think it's a, they say it's a disease, but I don't think there's a general understanding the nature of the disease that it's impossible to stop.
Well, what you're saying,
that's I think the first thing. The second thing is that the stigma that used to be associated with cancer, which has gone away to a very large degree, has gone away in no small part because of a general perception that we now have more successful treatments for cancer. And there's still some skepticism about the effectiveness of treatment for addiction.
Rightly or wrongly, David?
A little bit of both. We have much more effective treatments. We have many, many successful stories like Beth has been telling, which, of course, take a lot of work, as Beth has also been telling us. So there is much, much more effective treatment available, but it's not widely used, and there's some skepticism about its efficacy, and there's skepticism that this is a chronic condition rather than something that you just get cured from by one episode of treatment.
You know, the chronicity, we don't, you know, go back to the cancer. You know, we don't judge people when they're cancer, when they relapse.
Nor do we call relapse treatment failure.
Right.
But in addiction, our language is still that addiction relapse is failure, rather than what is accurately the case, an indication of the need for further treatment.
Let me take you off on a tangent. I'm curious about something. I read years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, there was an article that showed with smokers that the more often they tried and failed, every failure increased their chances of success.
That's correct.
And, so is that the case with addiction?
Yeah. I think that for many people, repeated tries lead to longer and longer periods of recovery. And so I think that's true with smokers, which is also our most common addiction, and with other drugs as well.
When you first got in the field 20 years ago, you said that the disease was widespread, treatable, and preventable. Those are some pretty bold statements.
It's still true. It's even more true today. And it would be more widely practiced with doing something about the kind of stigma that you're talking about. When I look at stigma, what I see is, for many people, a rational response to the discrimination they face when people find out that they have the disease of addiction. And I think we can do a lot about the discrimination. And if we do something about the overt discrimination against people with this disease, will go a long way toward reducing the stigma.
Such as? I mean, we've the public knows the data that, you know, that it's primarily organic. We've done the best we could. And when I say we, I mean, you know, all of us in the field and many of us in the media, we've done the best we can to put a human face on it. And
but employers are still allowed to actively discriminate against somebody with a past history of discrimination in hiring them. Government programs still have legal discriminations against people with past drug problems, so that a mother who has a past drug conviction is not eligible for infant feeding programs. people with drug convictions are often barred from employment that has nothing to do with their past addictive problems. So we have structured almost lifetime punishment into continued discrimination against people who have this disease. And as long as we don't act on these discriminatory policies, then stigma is going to continue unabated.
And, of course, all of that makes the prognosis so much worse, I would imagine, which reinforces the stigma.
Yeah. Now, we've made some dramatic progress recently because addiction is now going to be fully covered in the new health law. And so that's very important because it's now recognized as a disease worthy of treatment in the medical care system. That's a big, big positive change.
What do you see the implications of that being in the long run?
In the long run, we will move addiction back into the medical system where it belongs. It was removed from the medical system over most of the 20th century as doctors got the message that they really shouldn't be treating addicts. And as doctors got the message from a series of government policies and from their own educational institutions that stay away from this issue. It's really messy. You have a lot of addicts in your office and the DEA is going to come calling. And so we've really divorced the treatment of this disease from the medical system. I think the recent changes in insurance open up the possibility that it will get back into the medical system.
Well, there's also another dimension, and I'm proud to say this, that Philadelphia is really on the forefront of the recovery movement, which goes beyond symptom removal. We just had a large march here within the last few days on the recovery issue. And
this is an important part of the message that Beth is trying to deliver, that people who are in everyday life all around us are people who have had addiction problems and doing just fine. Thank you very much.
Well, here's the issue is that so many of these families are keeping it quiet, and that's too bad because they could be the teachers. We all need to be the teachers.
Blame them as long as making it public subjects them to all sorts of discrimination.
All right, so in the last couple of minutes we have left, I'm going to ask you the impossible question. What needs to be done?
I think we've made major progress by putting it inside the insurance system, and now we need to really deliver on that. We don't have the trained manpower, we don't have the facilities, and we frankly don't have the training in the medical system to accept responsibility for treating the disease. That's the first thing. The second thing is, we need to systematically examine the laws that discriminate against people with addiction. And the third thing, I think we need to educate people with addiction and their families and the general public that this is a chronic condition and that relapse doesn't mean failure. It means the call for new treatment, just as relapse in cancer and diabetes and hypertension.
And
we need more treatment.
And depression. You know, it happens, it reoccurs. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, and thanks to Beth and
her family for helping others understand this.
Take care. That was David Rosenblum. He's a professor of public health at Boston University. He directs Join Together, a program that helps communities prevent and reduce alcohol and drug problems. We are talking about stigma around substance abuse today. I promise we will get to your calls right after our break. When we come back and continue our discussion with Beth Grant and Dennis Franklin. Beth is a mother of a son who's battled heroin addiction. Dennis manages outpatient care at Livengren, a treatment center here in the Philadelphia area. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The French International School supports WHYY and invites you to discover the benefits of bilingual education for your child. With a program taught in English and French, the school offers students from preschool through eighth grade the opportunity to become bilingual at an early age. The French International School is located in Ballachinwood. The next open house is Friday, October 1st. Details at 610-667-1284 or efiponline.com. The French International School, education with a worldview.
Native American students have the lowest high school graduation rates of all ethnic groups in the U.S., but a new program is looking to change that by recruiting and training Native American educators.
Having Native teachers in that school allows that student to be comfortable in their own skin.
It's called the Sapsiquatla Project, and we'll tell you more about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about stigma around substance abuse. My guests are Beth Grant and Dennis Franklin. Beth is the mother of a young man who battles, we'll talk about language, heroin addiction, among other drugs. Dennis is a program manager for the outpatient care at Living Grin. It's a DNA alcohol treatment center here in Pennsylvania. And we've got lots of callers who want to join the conversation, so let's go right to the phones. We'll start with Stacy. Hi, Stacy.
Dr. Gottlieb, thank you so much for doing this program today. I'm a sober woman living in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And
are you there?
Yes, I am, and I live in a sober house in a very affluent community in Bucks County, and recently the community found out that our sober house was there and kind of called the community meeting to find out what we were all about. We had to have an open house for 2 days, kind of, you know, assuaging the community's fears about us being there. And we've also been asked to plant some buffer trees and kind of literally buffer ourselves from the outside community. Let's, you know, not see these people in our community. I kind of find it ironic. Certainly they don't want me driving around drunk in the community. That would be an alternative that nobody would want. So I find it ironic that they don't want to see us, but they also don't want us to be out and about drunk or using in the community either. I'll take my
Wait. Are you there?
I'm there.
All right. Stick with us. Don't run away just yet. So I'm a shrink, and there's a shrink question I have to ask here, okay?
Yeah.
So what's all that like for you?
I love sober life. I'm almost 4 years sober. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I live with other alcoholics and addicts, all who are active in the program, and the requirement of being in the house. You have to be active in the program and actively sponsored, so actually working a program. It's been a godsend.
I'm guessing you feel pretty good about yourself.
I feel really good about myself and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, how it's helped me,
okay,
and how now I'm able to help other people.
So let me ask my other question. Mm-hmm. When you were, I guess, discriminated against, that might be a strong word, by your neighbors, by the neighborhood, what impact did that have on you?
Well, I just thought, you know, really you'd rather me be in recovery than not in recovery, was my response. Like, you really don't want me to not have support.
Right.
If I run around not having support, then I'm not an active, healthy member of your community. I'm doing all those socially unacceptable things that alcoholics and drug addicts do.
So one of your reactions was anger or frustration.
I would say so. More so frustration at the community not understanding what addiction's about.
I want to know what it was like, what it felt like to be judged that way.
I think I'm so rooted in the program that I would say, you know, I understand that the spiritual foundation is anonymity, and that I'm all good with. But simultaneously, you know, this is, addiction isn't catching. If I rub against you, you don't get it. But I do understand that it's very fearful because it has that kind of shotgun effect in the community. It can hit anybody at any time, whether you're from an addict family or not. It takes young, old, yeah. It doesn't matter what color your skin is. So I understand where the fear comes from.
Well,
I also understand that, you know, the social stigma is still there because, you know, I steal when I'm drunk. I drive when I'm drunk.
So your understanding and compassion tells me that that you've been doing a lot of hard work in the program and with yourself. Thanks so much for your call, Stacy.
My thanks for the program. Thank you, Dr. Gottlieb.
Bye-bye. So I'm seeing a lot of reactions from Dennis and Beth. Dennis, you first.
Yeah, I couldn't help but thinking as she was talking. Certainly she has 4 years in recovery, and that's to be recognized as a great achievement. But I was thinking of the early recovering patients who are maybe in that house and, still getting that sense of shame. There must be something wrong with me. I have a disease of addiction. And, and it's that kind of stigma that still remains out there. So,
And this is hurtful. Although, thank goodness that this kind of thing happened in a group context and not when they were alone. And that... Yeah. That's a tremendous buffer. What mm-hmm. I was asking her questions about what it's like to be stigmatized. What's your answer, Beth?
Well, I'm really blessed in that I don't feel embarrassment ever. I have really not felt shame in my life.
How about your son?
Has my son felt shame? He's felt great shame, but great joy. And like when I heard Stacy's story, I thought about 4 years of sobriety. What an awesome accomplishment. And I thought about when our son graduated from his halfway house and was going on to a sober program in college. There's an Association of Recovery Schools. So that when you send your child off to college, there are actually universities that have programs, regular universities, tailored to kids in recovery. So, they might have 2,000 students not in recovery, but they have 50 students that they're focusing on in recovery. Anyway, when our son was graduating from his halfway house, I asked our friends if they would send him graduation cards. And they said, oh... Do you really want to remind him that he was a drug addict? Which struck me so funny.
I think he knows.
I said, I think he knows he was a drug addict. And many people were really reluctant to mark that momentous occasion. And I said to some of them, I sent your kid a graduation card and all he did was graduate from high school. My kid has overcome this tremendous challenge.
I wish... that message could get out. Something and you, Dennis, and I know, and many of our callers, that to say no, to be able to not use that day when everything in your brain says use, the kind of
when the culture,
courage and health, yeah.
Everything, when you celebrate, how do people celebrate? They celebrate with a glass of wine, a hard day at work. They come home and have a cocktail, a wedding, right. Champagne. Everything in our culture says use, use, use. And the people like Stacy and my son and other people in the community who are sober and have overcome that societal push toward substance use that can lead to abuse, their strength is phenomenal. They should be like superheroes.
Well, it also takes... or it helps that your son had the kind of mother that he has that could rejoice in his accomplishments. That is also atypical, I would imagine, Dennis, that a lot of parents, you know, reject their children or certainly keep arm's length.
Well, oftentimes parents will come to us after they've tried to hide it for such a long time, and they're at the point where I believe that sometimes they're even sicker than the alcoholic
sure.
or the addict is, and, you know, to try and help them to understand the disease concept can be challenging. So.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Vince on the line. Hi, Vince. You're on Voices.
Hi, Dan. I want to thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a recovering addict and alcoholic at 24 years, clean and sober, actually, this week.
I'm also
a licensed clinical social worker and worked periodically as a substance abuse counselor. I've noticed that within the treatment circles and also within the 12-step community that there's a lot of stigma against heroin addicts and other addicts that take drug replacement type therapies like methadone. But there's also other medications out nowadays. Heroin addiction, I'm so grateful I never used heroin, but heroin addiction is a terribly hard addiction to beat. When I worked with heroin addicts on methadone, I found that most of them did not present as intoxicated from the methadone, and they were generally very sincere about their recovery, but often couldn't get the recovery support they needed because of the stigma of being on methadone. And I was wondering if your guests could talk about that, or even you could talk about it. And unfortunately, in our society, we have a strong stigma about drug replacement therapies.
Yeah, I don't know if any of us could talk about it as eloquently and as clearly as you did. Dennis, any comment?
No, I agree that there is that stigma to the methadone patient in some treatment facilities, and it's a philosophy. But there are many support groups available to those people that are on methadone. There are, plenty of groups out there if people would choose to find them.
So even the support
network is there for them.
So even within the family, there are stepchildren and sub stepchildren who we discriminate against.
Absolutely.
So I guess the family of substance abusers is kind of like most other
families. It really has
families.
To start with us, the treatment facilities, to change that sometimes. So
we've only got a couple of minutes left before we speak with Mike and Scott about this wonderful mural arts program. But let me ask you both the big question. Beth, let me start with you. What's your vision about what needs to happen to diminish stigma and how it can happen?
I think that we need to be open with each other, be honest with each other, strip away all the artifices of who we are, you know, like how you dress and how you speak and where you went to school and where you work, and just be people with one another, because everyone has something to teach us. And as awful as our experience was with our son, and it was grueling on every level, he dismantled us from the inside out. No one can hurt you as much as someone who's been inside you, who, you know, I just can't even describe the process of what it did to us. On every level, it was devastating. But we were so strengthened from it at the end of the day. We learned so much about ourselves, about him, about other people. People in our community came to us, and they came in secret, but said, you know what? I was a drug addict. My husband was a drug addict. Look at us. You know, no one knows. Don't tell anyone. Please don't let this get out. You know, people that we didn't even know came to us and shared their stories and their hope with us, wrote to our son in his rehab facilities.
The hidden gifts that all of us talk about. Dennis, what are your thoughts about?
Yeah, I agree, and I think that really, educating certainly with the recovering community, stepping out and doing that. I don't think anybody's going to do that for the recovering community.
Right.
So getting that message out, and certainly this past weekend was a great way to do that.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been helpful and enlightening and a real public service. My guests have been Beth Grant and Dennis Franklin. Beth joined us to talk about her son, who's recovering from drug addiction. Dennis is program manager for outpatient care at Livengren, a drug and alcohol treatment center in Pennsylvania. And as I said earlier, joining us now is Mike and Scott. And Mike has been covering the Mural Arts Project at one of the aforementioned methadone clinics in North Philadelphia. It's part of a new collaboration between the Mural Arts Program and Philadelphia's Department of Behavioral Health. So one part of the mission is to reduce stigma surrounding mental health problems and addiction. Mike, and thanks for coming in and doing this exciting project.
Sure.
Or reporting on it anyway. So tell us about the project and how it worked.
So this project was truly a collaboration. There are people in treatment at this clinic, at the methadone clinic. Some of them have been addicts for many, many years. Their lives have been truly derailed by their addiction, so they're really trying to start again from scratch. So they are in treatment, and as part of their treatment, they started to work on this mural. And they really, it was a collaboration. They sat down with the lead artist. His name is James Burns. They started to write poetry. There were poetry workshops where they wrote, and these things then ended up being part of the mural. And then as part of their treatment, every week they would come to the basement and paint. And I think, you know, just not having that old-fashioned therapy really worked for a lot of them. It was a setting where they did something new. They were part of a creative process. They connected with other people, and they just hung out and talked, and it took their mind off a lot of things. So, you know what, why don't we, I have a couple of voices that I put together. Why don't we hear that collage real quick?
Connecting around art making can bring people together in a way that is unexpected. They don't look at us as drug addicts. You know, we're doing a project with them.
When I was painting it, I couldn't see it coming out to be nothing. And then as time went on, it took about 3 weeks. Then when I walked in and when they had it up, then I was like, wow.
It took the problems away. I would paint on the wall, and just everything seems to, you know, you're thinking about the pain, so I'm not thinking about my life, and I'm not thinking about myself, so whenever I'm not doing that, I seem to do a lot better.
She's become very involved with the artwork, and someone discovered that she can really write poetry, and she's really been writing since she's about 13. Just being here today, I see at least 5 of her poems, and that makes me very proud.
A program like this is everything to someone like me that wanted to do better for themselves and now has created a pathway that I can follow to do better.
Mike, and the project sounds really exciting. Where can our listeners see the final product?
Well, they can go to our website at whyy.org, and all the coverage is there. I think I started covering it in February, probably, and I just went to the dedication of the mural last week. The last two voices we just heard, by the way, were a mother and daughter pair, and the mother came several times, helped paint, actually, and there was just such a sense of pride in her to see her daughter, and I think being recognized for the poetry on the daughter's part was something that helped her get back on track, because she'd always been writing, had lost that, and now as part of her recovery, she's writing a lot again. So that's one part of this process of making a mural, but one part is really to also then have a huge visible result. This thing is big. We're talking a big building, and it's up there, and it really sends a message in a way.
Where's the building?
It's on 4th and Berks, which is in North Philadelphia. And of course, you know, part of the process is one mural by itself is not going to reduce the stigma of addiction. Sure. So people driving by might not even know, what is this about? Is it about addiction? I don't know. I think what's really crucial here is the process, because they bring in people who are going through a very difficult time, connect them with the artistic process. In addition, they bring in people from the surrounding community to volunteer, to help out, to hang out with these people and just to see what their lives are like. And that, I think, is really the big thing, is that one person at a time, you're connecting people with other people.
You know, we had a caller earlier in the show, Michael, Mike, and a woman in a sober house who was living in an affluent community. And that's what I was thinking of. You know, and they were discriminated against. They wanted to keep them at arm's length. And I was thinking, if they could just hang out together and get to know one another as humans, just exactly what this Mural Arts program is doing, it can help change both sides. What's next?
Yeah, this project, the Department of Behavioral Health in the city and the Philadelphia Mural Arts Program actually just received a grant to continue the work that they are doing around behavioral health issues. So there will be 9 public art projects that will go on in the city of Philadelphia that specifically address the topics of mental illness and addiction and work with people who are in treatment to create these artworks and to really start a conversation in different communities. And I hope the work will continue to go well. There was a really interesting workshop they did with homeless people around weaving, and they brought them in, and the homeless people, who many of them had mental illness, they started weaving, and that's another big mural going up very shortly. So we'll see what's...
And it's all part of the recovery movement.
Yes.
that I referred to earlier. It was a wonderful article about the recovery march in the Philadelphia Inquirer just a couple of days ago in late September. So thank you, Mike.
One more thing. When I went to the dedication of the mural, it was just so nice to feel that sense of pride from the families and from everybody who might have painted one tiny part of this big painting now.
Yeah, that's a different kind of pride than one associated with shame. That's genuine pride in somebody's personal accomplishments. Thank you, Mike, for joining us.
Sure.
Great, great. Mike and Scott's WHYY's behavioral health reporter. Well, next week, we're going to be talking about 2 documentary films that depict mental illness. We'll be here from the makers of OC87 and Unlisted, A Story of Schizophrenia. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at whyy.org, or you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Kevin Griffin is our engineer for today's show. Sherry Siegel is our intern par excellence. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, the host. Enjoy your week, my friends.